Hi folks, this is Bart from the Let's Talk Podcasts, guest hosting the Nosillacast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Saturday the 26th of July, and this is show number 481. Alison has the week off. Normally, I absolutely love hosting the Nosillacast. It's something I look forward to, and, you know, it's just good fun. But this time around, through no fault of anyone's, the timing hasn't turned out to be great. I've been pretty distracted all week because last weekend we got the bad news that a colleague from work and friend of mine, Liam Burbridge, died unexpectedly. In fact, I want to dedicate the show to Liam's memory. Alison never met Liam or interacted with him electronically, but I'm pretty sure that if she had, she would have given them the honour of being our people. Because, like the Nosilla castaways, Liam was driven by a desire to understand how things work. He had an insatiable appetite for learning, and he combined that with apparently boundless energy. I don't think I ever saw Liam walking sedately. He always seemed to be rushing from here to there to meet someone, to install something, to fix something, to troubleshoot some sort of problem. You know, he was always busy. But despite the fact that he was always busy and always rushing from here to there, he always made time for anyone who was in need of help. We're all going to miss him at work. I know his family are going to miss him dreadfully. He had a big heart. He loved his family greatly. He always spoke about them, always in the highest possible way. So my heart really goes out to his whole family. Liam, we're all going to miss you. And this show is dedicated in your honour.
This is Steve Davidson with a short review of the Radio Shack Bluetooth cassette adapter. Let's start with the problem to be solved. I drive a 20-year-old Honda Accord to and from work every day. No, that's not the problem. The car is great. Great acceleration, handles well, it's comfortable, and it gets 30 miles per gallon, or just under 13 kilometers per liter for those of you who use petrol. There is absolutely nothing wrong with this car, except for its lack of tech. Now, it does have a cassette tape player, but the AM/FM radio's tuner stopped working a long time ago, and I don't care because I don't listen to it. I prefer to listen to podcasts and audiobooks. So the problem to be solved is getting the sound from my iPod into the audio system so I can listen to my podcast, always at double speed, in comfort. I used to have a wired cassette adapter. You plug into the iPod's phono connector. The signal then runs down the wire and is impressed on magnetic transducers that convey the sound to the cassette player's read head. The only problem with that arrangement is that the cord gets caught on things, sometimes entangled with a 5-speed gear shift lever. Now, I travel a lot for work, and I've been getting spoiled by cars with built-in Bluetooth audio, so when the always-getting-tangled wire developed a break, I decided that it was time to upgrade. Bluetooth cassette adapters do just what you'd expect. Instead of the wire connecting an earphone jack, it uses Bluetooth to send the digitized audio signal to the cassette head. It avoids the wire and allows the iPod to be anywhere in Bluetooth range. I selected this particular model because of the specs. It claims 8 hours on a battery charge and uses Bluetooth version 4.0 plus EDR. So, how does it work? The audio quality is just fine for me. I don't listen to music, and I can't tell you what an audio file would say. For playing podcasts and audiobooks, it works just fine. And the Bluetooth range is quite good, but it is far from perfect. For one thing, I wish it had an auto shutoff so that if there was no Bluetooth connection or, even better, no audio content for a while, it would turn itself off to save battery power. Battery life can be an issue. With a wired adapter, it would go forever without recharging. The Bluetooth cassette adapter has to be recharged, and since there's no indicator of how much juice it has left in it, I find myself recharging it every 3 days or so. Since it's sitting in a motorized cassette player, with a spindle constantly being wound, how hard would it have been for them to attach a small generator to the sprocket so that it could self-recharge, if only to prolong battery life? That's a missed opportunity. It recharges via USB cable, which is good, but instead of the now ubiquitous micro USB interface, it has the throwback mini USB interface, so I need to use a different cable for that device than I do for most of my other USB-charged devices. And my final complaint. The single button design, press and hold for 3 seconds in order to pair, and press and hold for 4 seconds to turn it on. That ambiguity, coupled with the fact that the button is right next to the LED that tells you its state, and that LED gets covered by one's finger when one is pushing the button, That means that I frequently find it looking to pair when it should be synced with my iPod. Separate on-off and pairing buttons would have been preferable. So would I buy this again? I'm not sure. On one hand, I enjoy the absence of the cable, but on the other hand, it sure takes a lot more care and feeding. So I can't quite recommend it unless you know what you're getting into. This is Steve Davidson.
Thanks very much for sending in that recording, Steve. But as well as just sending in the recording, Steve also sent in a dumb question for Dumb Question Corner. So I'll stick in the music here.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
Dumb questions.
How do I?
What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
So the question Steve asks is, I know I've read that until a computer is completely shut down, the whole disk encryption key is kept in memory so the disk can operate properly. And because of this, a computer that is merely asleep is vulnerable to the possibility of someone plugging something into the FireWire or Thunderbolt port and doing a direct memory read, thereby capturing the key and rendering it moot. I've also read that there is a command that tells the computer not to retain the key when sleeping, and the command is sudo space pm set space minus a space destroy fv key on standby space 1. My dumb questions are, is any of this true? And if the first part is true, the key can be slurped out for a FireWire or Thunderbolt port. Is the second part, the command, safe and effective? Well, I guess the short version is yes, but maybe we'll give a slightly more detailed version. So, like Steve has said, whole disk encryption works by using a long encryption key to encrypt each block of data before it gets written to the hard drive. So, the operating system says, write this to disk, and then before it makes it as far as the disk, whole disk encryption is applied, and the block is encrypted, and then the only thing that ever hits the disk is the encrypted version of the data. Now, obviously, to get the data back off the disk, you need the key to reverse the encryption and present back up to the operating system whatever it was that was written down to the disk. And so this is why if you have whole disk encryption turned on your computer, whether it be Apple's File Vault or whether it be some sort of third-party system, whether it be in Windows, Linux, Mac, it doesn't make any difference. They all work in the same way. As soon as you power up the computer, there's going to be some little bit of code in the master boot record that says, please enter your password, which it will then use to look up the key, to decrypt the key, and then the key will be stuck in the operating system's memory so that it can read and write from the hard disk. And this is why if you turn on File Vault on your Mac, instead of logging in after the computer is booted, you'll be presented with a login window as soon as you power the machine on. And this is so that it can get the disk encryption key and start reading the disk so that it's actually possible to boot your computer. And so obviously, as long as the operating system is running, that key has to be in memory because otherwise it's as if you just ripped the hard disk out of the computer. Oh, so what happens when you put it to sleep? Because, I mean, we in the past we used to power up, do our something, and then shut down our computers. We don't do that anymore. I mean, my computer hasn't been powered off in months, probably. It might get rebooted the odd time, but it doesn't stay powered off for any length of time. And so the big question is, what happens when the machine goes to sleep? And that is entirely up to the software used for disk encryption. So the software can decide to nuke the key and then put some software into memory so that when the computer wakes up, the first thing it does is prompt you for your password again, and then it pops the password back into RAM and carries on as before. Or the other option is to simply leave everything as it is. So the key is in RAM, it's all working fine, just leave it there. And that has the advantage that it's more convenient, because it means that you can just close down the lid of your computer, it goes to sleep, that's that. You flip open the lid of your computer, and off it goes again, just like it was before. So convenient, security, your standard trade-off. So if you don't have the key nuked, you might think, well, surely it's safe in there. I mean, it's in RAM, great, but the RAM is on a chip soldered to the motherboard deep inside the computer. Surely the only way to get it out is some sort of James Bond-style rip open the back of the computer while it's running, find the little solder points that connect to the RAM, somehow hook in, and then read the memory like that. But unfortunately, that's not how it is in the real world because of something called DMA, or direct memory access. Now, to quote from the Wikipedia article on DMA, direct memory access is a feature of computers that allows certain hardware subsystems within the computer to access system memory independently of the central processing unit. In other words, some chips on your motherboard have direct access to memory without the operating system or indeed the CPU being in any way involved. And two of those little chips on your Mac motherboard that do that kind of thing, well, the same on a PC if you have these chips, are FireWire and Thunderbolt. And the reason they have DMA is not because, oh, it's a great idea to make Macs more hackable. It's because DMA allows Thunderbolt and FireWire to be what they are, which is spectacularly fast transfer mechanisms. They couldn't be that fast if they didn't have DMA. So again, we're into trade-offs. The advantage of using DMA is that it's really quite quick, and the disadvantage is you have now provided externally accessible ports with direct access to memory. And this is why, if you have a Mac that is in its default configuration that does have hole disk encryption, that is asleep, you can plug either a custom-made piece of hardware or just another computer into either the Thunderbolt or the FireWire port. And assuming you have the hardware set up correctly or some appropriate software on the second machine you plug in, you can use the Thunderbolt and FireWire protocols to read the RAM out of the other computer, even though the computer is asleep. And hence the problem. And there are people who have made these kind of devices about the size of a thumb drive. So you plug them in, you wait 30 seconds, you plug them out, and away you go. You know, that is a problem. And so the obvious solution is to stop the Mac doing its default thing, which is more convenient but less secure, and instruct the Mac to nuke the key when it goes to sleep. And you don't do that from the GUI. You do that using a terminal command, which is the pmset command that Steve gave in his question. PMSET stands for Power Management Settings, or Set Power Management Settings, and it allows you to configure what a Mac does and various things to do with power. One of those things is it allows you to tell it that when you go into sleep mode, nuke the file vault keys. And that is the command that Steve gave us. So is it effective? Yes, it is. It does exactly what it says on the tin. It nukes those keys before going to sleep. Again, the price you pay is you have to enter your password as soon as the machine wakes up, because without your password, it has lost access to all of its hard disks. So if you're concerned about this, then by all means, this terminal command will protect you from this particular vulnerability. So like I say, the quick version is yes, yes.
Help me somebody.
Hello, Mac geeks and photography enthusiasts. My name is Konrad and I'm a Polish photographer, currently based in the US. I would like to share with you today a landscape photo tip. Do you know this great feeling when you're out in nature, you suddenly see a beautiful landscape and you take a picture hoping it would look as beautiful as the landscape in front of you. But then, you look at the picture you just took and it looks awful. The picture seems flat and it just looks that it is missing something. I know that feeling, because I was there many times. The secret for taking landscape photos is to remember about three important composition components, namely foreground, middle ground, and background. There is a pretty good chance that the landscape picture you didn't like was missing at least one of these, so let me break it down for you. Foreground will include a part of the image that is the closest to the viewer. The background will be the opposite from the foreground. It will be the furthest from the viewer. What is left is the middle ground, which will be located between the foreground and the background. To understand it better, let's say you are at the seaside and you take a picture of the sea. In a typical picture with this three composition components, you would have the sand in the foreground, the sea in the middle ground, and sky as the background. It is up to you to decide how much or how little space will each of these composition components take up in a picture. I suggest that when next time you take a landscape picture, just take several different shots. For example, one with the foreground taking the majority of the space and a different one with the background dominating the composition. Unfortunately, there is no fixed formula on how much space these three composition components should take. It will depend on what and where your subject is and on your creativity. Oh, and have I mentioned that these three composition components also apply to other types of photography and not only landscapes? Let's go. I hope you enjoyed it and found my little tip useful. Thanks for listening and feel free to visit my website for more tips and tricks. Just go to konraddwojak.com, that's KonradDwojak.com.
Thanks very much for sending in that segment, Konrad. Very much appreciated. Just for listeners to note, the music behind Conrad's segment is Creative Commons. It's a piece called James Brown Defunk, Let's Go Bounce, and it is by Texas Radio Fish.
Hi guys, I'm sneaking in here on Bart's show because I am really excited to tell you that Clarify 2 has finally been released. You have so many options on how to order Clarify 2 via clarify-it.com. First of all, if you owned a copy of ScreenSteps 2.9, you can do an upgrade from that. If you had Clarify 1 for Mac or Windows, there's an upgrade path for those. There's an upgrade from Clarify 1 cross-platform license, or you can buy a whole new license if you didn't actually own it already. And the best part is, we have a coupon code just for NoSilla Castaways. This coupon code will get you 25% off, and it's good till September 1st, so act now. Anyway, the coupon code is NoSilla-C2 in all capital letters. I'm not going to have it typed on the website because mean people come and steal the coupon code. So write this down, NoSilla-C2, all capital letters, and you get 25% off. Oh, and remember, if you bought Clarify One directly from them, not the Mac App Store version, because they don't allow it, if you bought it after April 1st, 2013, you are eligible for a free upgrade to Clarify 2. Remember when they said that they were going to do that? Well, it's been a crazy long time to honor that agreement, but these guys are as good as their word. Heck, if you got Clarify One through the Mac Heist Bundle, they even have a path for a free upgrade for you. I have never heard of a developer giving that kind of free upgrade. You can also get Clarify 2 from the Mac App Store, but remember, like I said, Apple doesn't let the developers do discount codes or upgrade pricing, so you'll pay full price, but it's great to have it on all your Macs, and future installs are so much easier. The good news is that the guys over at Blue Mango Learning have given you every option possible to buy the way you want to buy. Now, here's something else fun. Don McAllister let me be a guest screencaster over on Screencast Online this week, so I seized the opportunity and I did a tutorial on Clarify 2. I have been planning that one for so long, and I was really thrilled that we actually nailed the delivery date exactly on the day that Clarify 2 was released. That was pretty much a miracle, because it happened while I was on vacation. Anyway, if you want to become a member of Screencast Online, head on over to screencastonline.com to subscribe. He's also going to include it in the next issue of SCO Mag on the iOS store for iPad, which is a really fun way to consume his videos and read a lot of great articles there, too, by some really brilliant people. Anyway, I don't think that issue is out yet, but when it is, that's a great way to do it. I could not be more excited about a product launch than I am about Clarify 2. Anyway, back to you, Bart.
And now for something completely different. So, I'm a huge fan of the comedy troupe Monty Python. It's been a while since I've been in their heyday. But, you know, I've been a fan of theirs for years, from the original Flying Circus sketch shows to their movies, especially The Life of Brian. The Life of Brian was so good, in fact, that it was banned in Ireland. Thankfully, radio waves don't respect international borders, so we would sneakily watch it on the UK TV station Channel 4 because, well, their signals, you know, happily flew over the Irish border and into Irish television sets. So I guess the fact that we weren't supposed to watch it made it extra fun. Anyway, the Pythons are sort of to surrealist comedy what the Beatles are to pop music, you know, the original and best, and the inspiration for an awful lot of what came after. If you don't know their work yet, by the way, I would recommend Monty Python Live at the Hollywood Bowl as a good starter. It's sort of the best of their clip shows performed live in the Hollywood Bowl in the US. Anyway, the Pythons performed a big series of farewell stage shows recently. In fact, last weekend, the last of those shows was broadcast live on UK TV Gold, which was fun to watch. And as part of the publicity for this big farewell season of shows, they also released a game, which is available on iOS and Android. Now, I didn't use it on Android because I don't own an Android phone, so I got the iOS version, which cost 99 euro cent and is a universal app. The game's based on a sketch from the old Flying Circus series, in which John Cleese plays a civil servant from the utterly farcical and obviously completely fictitious Ministry of Silly Walks. I can't really explain the Ministry of Silly Walks, so I've popped a link into the show notes to the to a YouTube video of the actual original Ministry of Silly Walks skit in all of its surrealist glory. So I'd say just watch the video, because I can't possibly explain. So the game is really simple. You play John Cleese's character and you walk along a continuously scrolling landscape, and you have obstacles that you have to either jump over or slide under. If you hit an obstacle, you die, and basically the more meters you go before you die, the better. Despite being spectacularly simple, it's actually really quite addictive. The longer you go on, the further you make it into the landscape, the faster everything begins to scroll, so your reflex has to get quicker and quicker and quicker. And as well as having to jump over and under obstacles, you can also collect coins, which you use to buy outrageous new suits for your character. And there's also special bubbles you can run into, which will temporarily muck with physics. So one of them makes you temporarily invisible, so that sort of gives you a bit of respite while everything is speeding up. Another one slows down time, which again gives you a bit of respite. And another one turns you into a coin magnet, so you just need to go near some coins and they fly towards you. It's an utterly daft and simplistic game, but it's surprisingly addictive and fun. So the Monty Python Ministry of Silly Walks game for iOS and for Android.
Hey, Bart and Nocilla Castaways, you know I can't really be on vacation. I have to send in something for Bart. One of the great challenges in life is arranging a group of people to show up at an event all at the same time. It might be a work meeting, a party, or a dinner out with friends, but you dread being the one to say, okay, who can come if we do it on Wednesday, and then have to dredge through 12 emails to figure out if it actually worked as a date, and of course Wednesday never works for Bob because of his chiropractor appointment. At work, I hated trying to set up meetings and events like this. What if you could have a system where you could offer a bunch of days and times, and it even allowed people to respond with yes, no, or if you made me, I could rearrange my schedule for that time? And what if this application was free? Maybe you could see what's coming because you're just so darn alert, but I have the solution for you. It's called Doodle over at Doodle.com. I think it was Don McAllister of Screencast Online who brought Doodle to my attention when he got us to use it to schedule the Mac Roundtable sessions. Remember when we used to do those regularly? Well, anyway, Doodle is awesome in its simplicity and how easy it is to get people together. There are a few tricky bits, so if you don't pay attention, it can get messed up. But lucky for you, I'm here to walk you through it. To do a doodle, which is just fun to say, doggone it, you simply push the big blue Schedule an Event button on the homepage of Doodle.com. You give it a title, then optionally you can give a location and description, but you don't have to, like I said. For the Mac Roundtable, we don't need that info, but maybe you want to make sure people know where the event is so they can be sure to enter the times they can go while taking into account travel for the event. Pop in your name and email address. Note, you have not had to create an account at all, but your address is required so that you get updates when people respond to the doodle. Next, you get to pick dates for the event. You can pick just a couple to start with and later add more if it turns out you haven't found a good time from that list. Simply tap on the dates in the calendar shown and go to the next screen. Now is the step where you pick times, and this is the first place you might have a problem if you don't pay attention. If anyone you're inviting is in a different time zone from you, then you have to click the link that says Switch on Time Zone Support. It's not super obvious and you'll probably miss it the first few times. If you forget to click it, you have to start the whole poll over again or have people responding at all the wrong times, which could be entertaining as well. They could make this a lot more obvious, and even once you click it, it's not very obvious that you've done it. The link simply changes to switch off time zone support. The next screen has the second tricky bit. You will see a section that says basic poll, and you'll be really tempted to just click next. Instead, click on settings, because this is where you can enable people to answer if need be to your poll. This is probably the single most useful thing about Doodle. Instead of having to listen to Bob's long drawn-out explanation of how hard it is to schedule a chiropractor, he could actually let you know that if you made him, he probably could reschedule it. In that same settings window, there are some other cool features. If you're a control freak, you might want to make your poll hidden so you're the only one who knows the results. You can also make it where each person could only choose one time for the event, and I'm not sure why you'd need that. The final option could be useful if you're, say, scheduling a set of classes. You can limit the number of participants per option. Maybe you only have room for 20 people in each class. You could use Doodle to schedule the classes very easily. Oh man, I wish I had Doodle when I was working. Your final option is whether you want to send the invitations yourself or whether you want Doodle to do it for you. I personally choose to send the invitations myself because A, I'm afraid my friends will think the doodle mail is spam, and B, I don't think it's good form to give your friends' email addresses to another company without their consent. Next, a screen pops up with a link you can email to people, and you also get an email that gives the link and a way for you to administer the poll. Remember, you can go back and add more dates and times later, but you can never enable the if need be feature after the fact. This is one of those things that sounds more complicated when you explain it than it really is. You give Doodle your contact information, pick candidate dates and times, send a link to your friends. Easy peasy. And of course, I've included a clarified document to walk you through doing a Doodle. One more thing. Bart always says to follow the money, and I mentioned that Doodle is a freemium service. You can pay to have many more advanced features for your business needs, and they give a comparison of the options you get if you pay over on their pricing page. Well, Bart, back to you.
Thanks for that, Alison. Just to echo Alison's recommendation of Doodle, I use it for organizing panels for Let's Talk Apple and Let's Talk Photography. It works really well as long as you remember that bloody time zone button. I can't count how many times I have had to do a poll over because I forgot to click that. Why, oh why, is it not a default? It's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond, and that should be Alison saying that, but she's not here. So I have, as a substitute Alison, I have invited in Mark Polly, who I think people on the podcast should know from being in the community for years and years. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Bart. How are you?
Not too bad. Now, do you want to let people know where your fantastic photographs hang out?
Sure. My photographs can be found at twinlakesimages.com. That's my website for my portfolio and blogging and a calendar of my exhibits and so forth. Also, I'm pretty active on Flickr as SwitcherMark.
Cool. And Twin Lakes is a region in, is it Washington State or which bit of the west of America?
It is in the very northeast corner of Washington State. My wife's family is from there, and we have some property there, so we spend a lot of time there, and that's kind of where I caught part of the photography bug.
So the Twin Lakes are to you what the Royal Canal is to me, a permanent muse.
Exactly, exactly. In fact, tomorrow we are hopping in the car and driving over for our annual two-week visit, so I'll be hopefully adding a whole bunch of new pictures to my collection of Twin Lakes pictures.
Excellent. Cool. So the topic I have sort of picked out for today is sort of my approach to taking realistic-looking photographs at dusk. And this is sort of, I recently, I think it was last week, I edited one that I'm really quite happy with. So that one's in the show notes. So it's the one with the train at dusk. And I shot that about 6 months ago, but I'm so far behind editing shots that I actually did the edit yesterday. Sorry, not yesterday, about a week ago. And it got quite a bit of positive feedback, and I thought, you know, and people were making comments like, ooh, you really captured the natural light and stuff. And I thought, well, actually, there's nothing natural about that. That actually took an awful lot of editing. Maybe that's worth talking about.
It is a challenge because it looks so beautiful to our eyes, but it's hard to capture on a picture.
And I guess in Nosillacast style, we can say that the problem to be solved is the fact that our eyes and our cameras see the world really quite differently. Basically, the problem is the dynamic range. So our eyes can see a greater difference between the darkest thing it can make out and the brightest thing it can make out. Than our cameras sort of can when used in sort of JPEG mode and sort of regular take a picture, look at the back of the camera mode. And during the day, that doesn't really make that much difference. The shadows are usually a little bit darker than they are in real life, but if you properly lit the subject, that's probably not a problem. But as soon as you come to dusk, it really becomes obvious because the foreground at dusk is generally quite dark, but our eyes are perfectly able to see what's there. And then you often would have the sun either just above or just below the horizon, depending on whether it's, well, you know, dawn or dusk. It works both times of the day. And when you take a picture, just you walk out with your camera in that light, you take a picture, you don't get the results that your eyes get. You get something quite boring, usually. Most of the foreground missing.
And it seems like that because of that dynamic range, if you expose on one or the other, it really exaggerates the problem. So not only is it a problem, but it gets exaggerated because of the way that you expose out of a picture, it seems.
Yeah, because if you aim for the ground, you just completely lose the sky. If you aim for the sky, you completely lose the ground. If you go for a halfway house, you get nothing.
Right.
So that's not good. And the other problem is, even if you do manage to get something, there's also a mix of white balances involved, because the sky is being sunlit still, so it's a daylight white balance, but the ground is now in shadow, so it's a shadow white balance. And if you don't deal with that, even if you do correct for the first problem, you then end up with the second problem, that the ground has gone blue, usually.
Oh, right.
That doesn't look very good to the guy either. So you kind of have to deal with both.
And how do we do that?
Well, so there's one, right, so the first approach I just want to mention, because it's not really something I do a lot, but I do it sometimes, is sometimes you just pretend, you just say, okay, fine, our cameras are limited, I accept this limitation, and instead of working against it, I will choose to work with it, and basically what that means is you silhouette stuff.
So
you
say
to yourself, I am intentionally going to just let the ground go to nothing, I'm going to compose in such a way that that's not a problem. I don't do it very often, but I have done it a few times, send up with shots that I'm, you know, prepared to put my name to and say, that's one of mine. So I have just four examples in the show notes. You can sort of use reflections to cheat a bit to get rid of some of the blacks in the foreground by simply having, you know, sky on the ground as well as on the land. So I have one of my Royal Canal shots. Or sort of it's more normal just to silhouette a skyline. So I have a wind farm against the setting sun, and then the ruins of a church against the setting sun, and a bridge against sort of a setting sun. And that's right. Yeah, that's a perfectly valid artistic approach. It's just I really like the feel of dusk, and I don't think that a silhouette captures it. The other thing you can do, of course, is the opposite of a silhouette. So, okay, fine. With the silhouette, you say, I don't care about the ground, I'll take the sky. And the opposite is, I don't care about the sky, I'll take the ground. And so, I really don't do this very often, but I did do it once in the last year, where I said, okay, fine, I'm just going to let the sky blow out, I don't care, and just let the ground come in. And it actually worked. So there's one example in the show notes, and I looked at my whole photo library, and I've only done this once, to get a shot that I actually thought was worthy of going up on Flickr. But in this case, I sort of liked it because the shadows were long.
And this is the green, the big open green space. What is this?
So you have a big open field with a train sort of spinning through the side, and then
the sun is
setting behind a tree. But of course, because the sun is right on the horizon, that tree's shadow is like, you know, 300 yards long.
Right.
Which is
that's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting.
But like I say, I've done that once ever.
And I mean, because you've made that choice. All of that, I mean, the picture, the frame has to really be dominated by that scenery. You're not going to have much sky there, so the horizon is real high in the image.
Yeah, because it's all gone anyway. Yeah. One other thing you can do if you want to avoid a lot of processing is turn your back on the sun. So this only works when the sun... So if you're doing this in the evening, it only works sort of in those 15 minutes before the sun sets. And if you're doing it in the morning, it only works in those 15 minutes after the sun rises. But if you turn your back on the sunrise or sunset, there's actually really pretty light. And if you can avoid getting your 500-foot shadow into the field of view, it's just beautiful and doesn't take much post-processing. So I have one example where I managed to pull that off years ago in Flanders. And, of course, being me, it was a sunset, not a sunrise. I don't do mornings.
One of my favorite pictures is I did the same thing on a bridge facing away from the sunshine, but get a nice purple glow on a mountain in the city and so forth. It was really one of my favorite pictures.
Because that light, so, you know, we all know that the colors are lovely on the side the sun is setting or rising, but actually on the very far horizon, it's usually very pretty as well.
Right. Well, and if you have something for that color to be reflecting off of, it's usually pretty nice too. So
yeah, if someone's gone and conveniently put some white snow on a mountain, yeah.
Exactly.
That's very nice of them. So these are, you know, these are all artistically valid approaches, but it's not what I wanted. So I've sort of spent literally years perfecting something to catch a sort of a more realistic dusk view by trying to use the fact that a raw image captures way more information than you can squeeze into a JPEG, and a whole bunch of post-processing to try to recover enough of the shadow detail to have my cake and eat it. So basically to get the sky and the ground at the same time.
Right.
And so I have some examples of sort of the feel I'm hoping for. And the first example I chose, because it's the same scene as one of the silhouette examples, so it's the same church, the same tower, the same graveyard. So it's in silhouette in the previous examples, and then here it is with detail in both, and it's a very different picture.
Right, and I really like that. That's it's amazing that you can get the color in the sky the way that you did, both in the silhouette and the other one, but still have some the detail of the church. I like that. That's very good.
And again, you know, the leading line of the path is actually one of my favorite features of that location.
And you lose that in the silhouette.
Yeah, you just can't have it. So in the silhouette, the ground is just completely cropped away because it adds nothing but weight to the image. Whereas if you can retain, and you don't have to retain like lots and lots and lots of foreground, like you just got to get enough. So another example then is along the canal. So again, you have just a hint of the path is just enough to pull the eye through the image.
Right.
And then another one sort of again, a sort of a landscape. And that day actually was just amazing because I've been in that lake 1,000 times and it's never been that still except for that one evening.
So on that image, how late in the evening is this? Or how the sun is already down?
The sun is down.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. So that is basically the scene is being illuminated by the glow from the sun, from the already set sun in the sky.
Right. Wow. I don't know that I would have. I mean, the other ones are, you can clearly see where the sun is, or you can see that it's really low. That one, I don't think I would have picked that out. It looks very bright.
And then the final one is the one we're going to do as a sort of a worked example, which is the one we started with. So the train, you have the half of the sun sitting on the horizon, and you have the train pulling through the scene, but there's still some detail in that foreground. It's not a silhouette, because obviously otherwise we'd have lost the train apart from just the three headlights.
Right.
Huh. So we're going to work through that as an example, and the sort of the process actually starts before post-processing, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
So if I'm going to do this to an image, I need to know that while I'm taking the picture, because otherwise I'm not going to take it in such a way that lends itself to the processing I want to do afterwards. And so as much as I know some people don't like to hear this, but the way you do this is you put your camera in full manual mode.
Yeah, scary.
I know. you can work around it if you can get away with it in something like aperture priority and then using exposure compensation. But actually what you're doing there is making your life difficult because you're telling the camera it has control and then you're saying, no, do it this way. So if you just put it in manual, you just get the control straight up. And I know it's scary, but a little bit of practice and, I just want everyone to learn to use their camera in full manual. That's real photography, but that's just my prejudice.
Okay, so how do I do it?
Okay, so without even having to think about it, there's some things I just do automatically. So first off, make sure you're using RAW mode, because otherwise this ain't going to work. If you don't shoot in RAW, what you get is what you get, and you can't do anything with it in post. So make sure you're in RAW mode, and then what may be counterintuitive is manually set the white balance to daylight. So the little sun icon or 500 Kelvin, or 5,000 Kelvin. And the reason for that is that is actually what will give you a realistic sky. And so my approach is basically get the sky in camera, fix the ground in post.
Right, because now why is that?
Well, the temptation would be to go for a warmer white balance because that will enhance the oranges. But that will have a really nasty effect on the blues. And if you're actually out at dusk, straight overhead is blue. And it's a rich, deep blue. It's the start of what's called the blue hour, which is the beautiful hour after sort of that hour or so after sunset where the sky has this rich, deep blue. So overhead, it should be blue. It shouldn't be purple or washed out orange. It should be blue. And then the oranges on the horizon should be orange, but they shouldn't be bright red. They shouldn't look like something from a cartoon.
So we're going to set this shot thinking that the sky is our primary thing. So white balance or exposure or whatever, we're going to be working on the sky first or yes. Primarily.
Yes, exactly. And ultimately that's always going to be the strongest feature of a dusk shot. And then you just want to recover enough foreground detail to make it feel right.
And isn't it, if you blow out the sky, you're not going to be able to recover it, right? So that's correct. Isn't that why it's more important to get the sky right?
It is. So the easy bit is those two settings. You just dial those in and you don't think about it. And then comes the hard part where you have to balance the exposure triangle. And like you just hit the most important point on the head. If you lose the sky, it is gone. So you can't lose it. But, because everything's always trade-offs, you actually still want to get the exposure as high as you can get away with, because the darker you let the foreground become, the more work you have to do in post, which means the more you're going to amplify the noise. So what you're trying to do is find this knife edge where you have it as bright as you can possibly get it without leaving the sky, but no brighter. And if you misjudge that, you've ruined the whole image. Which is a little bit scary. But the nice thing with digital photography is you can just, you know, take 5 or 6.
Keep trying. That's right. Just keep trying.
Exactly. And so I always have my camera set to blink and show the highlights. Or sorry, show anything that's blown out. And so what I will do is I will find the exposure point where there's nothing blown out, and then I will give it 2 clicks brighter, which is 2/3 of a stop, because I know that the raw file captures more than will be shown in the JPEG.
Okay, and, say that again.
Okay, so you find the point where there's nothing blown out. So nothing blinks.
Right.
And then you take the exposure and you increase it by 2 clicks of the little thumb wheel at the back, which in my camera is 2/3 overexposed.
So you're going to blow out a little bit.
You're going to blow out a little bit, but it's not really blown out because the raw file is capturing at least an extra stop. So I'm only dialing in 2/3 of a stop, so I have a safety margin.
Okay.
And I know the raw file has my back.
I was trying to make sure I got the right direction. So you set it perfect, and then you go a smidge too bright.
Correct.
Okay.
And the only reason is because that will help you with the shadows, and you know the raw file has your back.
All right. Got it.
The other thing that you would like to do, so you definitely have to get the exposure right. There's no two ways about that. The other thing you would like to do, if possible, is keep the ISO low. You may not get away with it, but if you can, keep it civilized anyway. Don't go mad with it. And because the more you put up the ISO, the more noise there will be, and everything we do in post-processing amplifies noise. So the less of it you have to start, the less it's going to get amplified, the less you have to deal with it later. And then the third priority, and really, you know, they're in that sort of order, definitely don't blow any highlights. Try keep the ISO low. And if you can do all of that and still get a decent depth of field by keeping the aperture to about f8, then you're absolutely in the butter zone. But you may not have that option. You may have to sacrifice that, but that's fine.
So is this why we're doing this in manual? Because if we tried to get the sky right, it's going to throw off the ISO or something. Yeah.
Basically, what we want to do is we want to make these trade-offs in this order, because these are the actual priorities. So whereas the camera in an automatic mode is going to do whatever it thinks is right, which may be not at all in this order. So it may decide, oh, I really got to keep that depth of field, so I'm going to keep it at f11. Therefore, I'm going to go to ISO 6400. I mean, goodness knows what the camera will do in an automatic mode. You've just left it up to whatever the software engineer thought was a good idea in the general case. Now, this isn't the general case. This is a very specific case. So, again, the more control you take, the less you're fighting with the camera.
Well, and it's just figuring out based upon what it senses as far as the light. So it could throw it one direction or the other really poorly for you. So
exactly.
Yeah.
And if you're using one of the semi-auto modes, you're going to be taking a bit of... You're going to do a couple of tests just to get that point where the exposure is right and so forth. And as you're doing this, unfortunately, the sun is setting, so the variables are changing a little bit, which means that the automatic compensation is going to be jumping around. And so you're going to try to tweak it, and it's going to be jumping a different way. It can be done, but goodness me, is it frustrating to do it in one of the semi-auto modes. For your own sanity.
Manual, you're pushing me to manual. There we go. Okay.
So at this stage, you're going to take the shot, and it is going to look awful. But this is fine. This is expected. So I have in the show notes the raw output as it falls out of the back end of the camera. What you have is the sun disk on the horizon, 3 dots on the front of the train, and the teeniest of tiniest of bits of foreground detail.
Okay.
All right, the shot has mostly looks awful, frankly. But that's
pretty flat. I mean, it's flat and really nothing wants to stand out.
Yeah, it's basically a terrible photograph. But that's fine, because this is like the raw data that we are now going to transform into a photograph.
Okay, I trust you.
So the first step is to get that information that raw file has for us and get it out. And the process for doing that is something called tone mapping. And it's basically a bunch of math, or maths, as we'd say in Europe. And what it does is it looks sort of at a pixel-by-pixel basis, and the pixels that are underexposed get brightened, and the pixels that are overexposed get darkened. And you have a whole bunch of sliders to tweak it to make it look the way you want. So in effect, the bright bits of the image get darkened, the dark bits get brightened. The end results, on average, every bit of the image is getting closer to being properly exposed. And therefore, we should regain our foreground, because that's really what we've lost.
Okay.
Now, Photomatics Pro is what I use, because I think it's the best tone mapper out there. And I'm afraid to say there is no dial in these settings and it will always work. Photomatics is an art. And although what I have in the show notes a screenshot of my starting point. So I have these saved as a preset, and I use these as my starting point, and then I work from there. Because I found that I always end up about here. So instead of starting from the defaults and then doing a lot of work to get to here, I just dial these in as my starting point. But then you have to tweak every single time, and it's always a little bit different. So they're in the show notes as a helping point, but ultimately there is no substitute for practice here. You know, do it, it'll look awful, do it again. Once you get the knack of it, you'll start to understand what all the sliders do, and you'll be able to do it in a few minutes. I mean, I now open up Photomatic's slide size like done, but it took a lot of getting it awfully wrong to get anywhere close to being able to just feel comfortable in there. And I can't give you a shortcut to that. You just got to learn the tool.
And I also use Photomatics, and I don't think I'm as good as you. I really struggle with it. I bring stuff in. The presets that they have are really strong. I mean, they go, they're really wild every direction. And I think maybe my issue is that I haven't quite found this happy place yet.
It's very, very easy to make a cartoonish looking image with Photomatics.
Right. Yeah.
The hard part is to get a photo like image out of Photomatics.
Right.
I have literally, and I'm not exaggerating, I spent years getting this preset. And as I say, this is my starting point. I always tweak from here. So what you see in the screenshot is my starting point, and I have it saved as a preset called Bart Starting Point. And the first thing I do in Photomatics is I click that preset. And then the very next thing I do is adjust the white balance slider. Sorry, the white point slider. Because basically that's going to determine what is and isn't blown out on the highlights end. And so I will set that as bright as I can until I lose detail somewhere I care about. So basically slide it all the way over till it's definitely all blown out, and then bring it back right up until you stop seeing a change anymore. And that is as bright as you can go without losing data in something that matters. And once that white point is set, you're usually close to something decent. Then I might add a little bit of a black point if the ground is looking too blown out, which is not going to happen on a dusk image, to be honest. You'll notice I have the gamma set spectacularly high. That slider is almost all the way to the left. And that's what gives you sort of a more natural look. And the other one that's really important is that lighting adjustment is all the way to the right. That gives you this. If you let that slider come back the way, you get halos and horrible, horrible effects. What that's doing is it's basically saying, at no point is the difference between the adjustment I make it. What you're saying is you can't have something really bright next to something really dark if you have that adjustment set all the way up to 10, which means you can't have halos.
Which one are we on?
So this is the lighting adjustment, which is all the way to the right. It is the only slider that I have pegged, and I always peg it, and it never moves from there.
So that is one of the issues that I have the biggest problem with whenever I use Photomatics, is that even when I think that I've done a pretty good job and I bring it back over to Lightroom or wherever I'm working with it, there's always just a hint of a halo somewhere, and then I fight to get rid of it. So that the lighting adjustments.
The lighting adjustments basically tells you how dramatic the algorithm can be applied. And so if you bring the lower that value, effect, the more haloing you're going to get.
Oh, okay.
And basically, what you'll also see, of course, is that the more you bring that to the left, the brighter the foreground will get, because it will really go to town on making changes. But by putting it all the way to the right, you're basically saying, yeah, I know you want to make really dramatic changes, but I am limiting the rate of change as you move from one part of the image to any other part of the image. And so that does is just it's subtle. It makes the whole effect more subtle, because you're saying, no, you can't be dramatic. You have to be realistic. You have to be naturalistic.
Okay.
So that's probably actually the single most important slider, and I never move it from there.
Well, and I was going to... you mentioned the gamma slider, and then you went on to the lighting slider, and you got my attention. But going back just a second, the gamma slider, that also is, that's the one.
Right,
but is that, if you overdo that, isn't that the one that really makes, if you're, I know we're not doing HDR, and I don't want to take us off track, but that's the slider that gives that kind of odd, painterly effect.
That's the one called tone compression, which we'll come to in a second.
Okay. All right, I'll back up. I'll let you go.
what the gamma will do is it will give you a very the gamma is effectively contrast. So if you have the gamma far to the left, you have a sort of a contrasty image, which is what we want, because, you know, so in other words, the shadows are still shadowy, they just have some detail in them. And if you were to take that slider the other way, you get a very, very flat image.
Okay.
There'd be very little contrast.
Okay.
So I generally find that the gamma has to be high to give a natural-looking image, because by default, tone mapping wants to bring that foreground the whole way up to being fully exposed, which would look completely unnatural, because when we're looking at a sunset, we don't see the foreground as if it's being lit by a spotlight. We see the foreground really quite darkened. But we just don't see nothing.
Right.
So the tone compression... So basically, I will start with this preset. I will adjust the white point, maybe adjust the black point, tweak the gamma a little bit. And then, if it doesn't look right, then the two sliders that I really concentrate on are the tone compression and the strength. And tone compression is basically how much extra from the raw file we're letting in. And... Okay. You need to be subtle with that slider, because if you go too far one way or the other, it very quickly becomes line drawing. Like, it very quickly becomes arty in a bad way.
When you say how much extra from the raw file, what are you talking?
So, the raw file has basically a stop and a half of information left and right of what we can normally see on our screens. So basically, we can see 8 bits. Our cameras usually capture, I think it's 11. So that's 3 in total. Half of it to the bottom, half of it to the top, if you get what I mean.
Okay.
And so if you use that tone compression, if I were to slide that tone compression dramatically over to the right, the whole foreground would just light up, basically as if it was trying to get the foreground perfectly exposed, which will look terrible. And it will darken that sky right back, and it will really exaggerate the effect of the HDR. Now, you need a little... Now, in this case, I actually didn't need any tone compression. It worked just fine without... This is my starting point. I usually find I don't go beyond 1.5 on that slider. So basically 1.5 at the little lines.
Okay, so just barely.
You're just injecting enough that you see the fact that there is a foreground. And then if it looks unnatural, I tend to dial back the strength slider at the very, very top. So I started with it at 70, but I'd often go back to 60 or 50.
Okay, so is the strength slider basically saying how strong... I'm going to define the word by asking, by using the word, but is it the strength slider is saying this is how strong all of these adjustments are? Is it basically controlling everything below it?
I have this mathematical equation with all of these inputs that are all of these sliders. How much oomph do I put into that equation? How much do I let the equation mess with the pixels?
And I know that this is incorrect. It's not the same thing. But is the strength slider sort of like an opacity slider on something else, where it's saying this is going to control everything? This is how much of all of these adjustments you're going to see.
Sort of, not exactly, but that's not a bad analogy.
Okay. Whew.
What it will, because it's not just how much of it you see, but it's also how much of it is applied. So it's how you bias the math. So if you style that right up, you'll have really, really strong halos. Like if there's even the slightest, if you put that strength all the way up, if there's the slightest hint of a halo, it's not the slightest hint of a halo anymore. And if you turn the strength to zero, then nothing you do in any other slider has any effect whatsoever.
So, okay.
Yeah.
So you, and... looking at the show notes, you have it set about 2/3 of the way up or so.
Yeah, that's...
And that's where you want to start at, and then you move it. And then is that the last place that you go? So you do all your other adjustments and then say, I'm going to reduce the strength a little bit, or I'm going to increase the strength a little bit.
I do tend to leave that to last.
Okay.
And usually it's like, ooh, does it... Okay, this is going a bit unrealistic. Just dial it back a little. And I, you know, usually 60 or 50 is fine.
Okay.
I very, very rarely I'll strengthen it, but very rarely, because that usually ends up with your grungy looking image, which is not what I'm going for. And I'm not saying anything wrong with the grungy look, it's just not my intention.
The intention here is realistic. Obviously, exactly. you can do artistic things with this, but right now we're working on trying to get something realistic.
Exactly. So I have chosen to use this tool in this way. This tool can also be used to do a million and one other things.
Right. Okay.
Now, one thing I probably should have said before we went into to Photomatics is that because I shoot Nikon, I don't send the raw file straight into Photomatics, because Photomatics is known to be bad at dealing with NEF files, which is the raw format Nikon use. So I bring it into Aperture first and then export it as a 16-bit TIFF. And since I have it in Aperture anyway, I usually use the recovery and black point sliders in Aperture just to stop there being anything blacked out or blown out.
Before you come into this.
Before I come in. So what Photomatics gets is an image where the shadows are not... Basically, there's a feature in Aperture called the highlight hot and cold areas that will turn any pixel that's black bright blue and any picture that's blown out bright red. And so I will take the recovery slider to get rid of the reds and then take the black point slider to get rid of the blues. And then send that off to 16-bit TIFF and into Photomatics.
You didn't say it before, but I'll go ahead and ask it now. Do you do any other adjustments before you bring it into Photomatics?
No.
Just that.
Just that.
Okay.
Because really, you got to sort of get the detail out, and then you start your real editing work. So this is very much phase one of. So I sort of think of it as developing the raw file into its potential. So getting all that detail out. And the chances are, it is a fact that when you do that, you end up flattening the image and making it look a little bit sort of, you know, it starts off flat because it's all dark, and it ends up flat because there's actually sort of not enough contrast left after you bring back all that detail. So if you can see in the show notes, the second image is how it came out of Photomatics. So,
right. I was just going to admit that I actually made a mistake. When we were talking earlier, I made a comment and I said, ooh, that picture's so flat. And I just realized that I'd scrolled to the wrong thing. And I was looking at the image that we're talking about right now, which is at the end of tone mapping. It's there, but flat. It's very flat.
And, you know, you'll notice there's an awful lot more of that foreground detail has come in.
Right.
You can count the bricks on the bridge if you feel so inclined. So, in fact, you can see that someone's left some nasty cables lying around as well, both people. So, you know, we have got our detail back, but we have lost the punch from the picture. It had no punch because it was too dark, and now it has no punch because it's gone too flat. But that's fine. We are making progress.
And when we say flat, what do we mean?
Lacking in local contrast. It just doesn't feel... Everything seems the same. It seems, you know, there's no noticeably bright parts, no noticeably dark parts. Well, not enough notably bright parts and enough notably dark parts. It just feels uncontrasty.
Okay. It feels flat.
It feels flat, yeah. I can't really think of a better word for it than it feels flat.
Yeah, okay.
So the next tool in my toolkit is the Topaz Adjust plugin. And what Topaz Adjust does is it can do many things, but what we're going to use it for is to inject sort of very carefully applied contrast. So it's sort of the term for it, I think, is local contrast, where you're not changing the fact that the foreground still has detail in it, but you're putting back in enough contrast to make it not look flat. But you're not doing it universally. You're only putting in the contrast where it's needed. Which is why it's called adaptive exposure, is sort of the section within the Topaz settings that we really care about.
Okay.
And again, what I have here is a snapshot of sort of my preset and then I tweak very subtly from here every time. So basically, adaptive exposure to about 0.2, regions to about 10, give or take. Sometimes I'll need contrast, sometimes brightness, but I always, always, always protect those highlights very strongly and remove the shadow protection. Because if you leave the shadow protection in, it will keep the dark bits bright, which is not what you want. You need actual blacks in a photograph to make it feel proper. And you need strong whites, but you don't want to lose the detail in the sky. So that is sort of what I have found to work, and I will tweak that just like I did in Photomanics. That's my starting point, then I'll tweak it a bit, and I usually also throw in a little bit of saturation boost and a little bit of detail boost, but again, that's optional, that's very much fine-tuning.
Okay, now this is not a how to use Topaz segment, and I don't want to take you too far off, but can you... You said that this is for local adjustments, not overall.
Well,
is
no,
that,
it's an adjustment you apply overall, but it doesn't...
Right.
Topaz, again, it's a mathematical algorithm again. And the mathematical algorithm applies contrast where contrast is needed. So the bits of the image that are fine are left alone, and the things that need enhancing are enhanced.
Okay. And again, I don't want to take you too mm-hmm. far off on Topaz, but what's the difference between the adaptive exposure and the regions? What am I controlling when I'm sliding those one way or the other?
The adaptive exposure is how much of this local contrast to pop in, and the regions is sort of the scale at which it should be applied.
Okay.
And if you're not careful, basically if you have the region set wrong in one way, you won't see any change to your image, and if you have it set wrong the other way, it'll look like a cartoon.
So adaptive exposure, if I was to go way up, I'm making it much brighter. I may be misusing the word.
No, what you're going to do is you're going to emphasize every line.
Okay.
So you see the way on the bridge you have, say, you have dark ballast and then you have whiter concrete.
Okay.
For the bridge structure. If you were to go bonkers with that, that dark ballast would go to black and that brighter concrete would go to white.
Yeah, I'm emphasizing the as I go up, I'm emphasizing the contrast.
Yes, but it's not contrast in a global sense. It's contrast between the pixels near me.
Okay.
So it's very much looking at every pixel and its neighbors, and then making tweaks to make them more different to their neighbors, rather than sort of looking at a big overall. Because if you do an overall contrast adjustment, it's just everything that's near black gets blacker, everything that's near white gets whiter. But in this case, it's looking at a much smaller scale and saying, I just want to make these pixels that are close to each other more different from each other.
And regions, then, is doing what?
Is how, what scale do I apply this to? So do I look... I usually work about 10 pixels across, which is basically what the 10 is. So if you make the regions very big, it'll apply the same maths, but just to a bigger region at a time. It's sort of analogous to when you're applying sharpening, that you sort of have to say, what scale do I apply this math to? It's basically swizzle around the sliders and you'll soon see that it makes a very big difference.
Okay.
And
so it's how big of an area, defining how big or how small of a area that it's working in.
Yeah, it's how fine grained should I get? Basically, what size of detail should be emphasized?
Okay, I think that makes sense. And you're typically going to be working on smaller regions, not bigger regions.
If you want a naturalistic looking effect, yes. If you start to make the regions go bigger, then you're going to end up with quite similar problems to what Photomatics can give you with haloing and generally quite a painterly sort of unnatural look.
Okay, so there's a theme here, which is judicious use of sliders, both in Photomatics and now in Topaz. We're not overdoing this.
Correct, and that will hold true actually the whole way through the process. It's always, you know, subtle tweaks of the sliders, generally speaking.
All right.
So at this stage, you sort of emphasize the details you want to emphasize. You've gotten back the details that were in the raw file, and you sort of corrected for the fact that Photomatics has flattened the image a bit. But what you have done now is at every stage in this process, any noise there is has been amplified. And so at this stage, I will sort of make a decision, and I will look at it, and I will go, is that more noise than I can tolerate, yes or no? If the answer is no, then fine, carry on. If the answer is yes, I will run it through Topaz denoise at this stage.
Right.
Which, in the case of the actual example image I did, it was borderline, so I ran it through subtly. You have to be very careful with all sliders in Topaz denoise. That's a talk about a black art. But I make very, very small adjustments in there, because otherwise you just end up with an out-of-focus horrible thing with no detail left.
Right, because that's, I mean, basically, isn't denoise, it's unsharpening. It's taking the it's flat. It's taking it out of focus, flattening it out. What, I don't know which what term.
And, well, what if it tries you do it to do is it tries to blur detail below a certain size and emphasize detail above a certain size. So it's like a blur and then an unsharp mask.
Right. And if you do it too much, it's just gonna there's gonna be no detail left at all.
Correct. And yeah, you're just it's gonna become sort of like a line drawing. It's got all the outlines of all of the bits you started with, but it, you know, the gravel has ceased to be gravel. It's just brown goo. You know, everything just loses its reality. It's very easy to get a plastic looking image. So I would say, you know, whatever denoise app you use, less is more. Just nudge those sliders. Don't go wild with them. So at this stage of the game, we now have the third phase image, as we see in the show notes. And that is already a presentable photograph, but it's not ready, in my opinion, for prime time. But it's well on the way to being ready for prime time. So at this stage, I move into aperture. You could move into Lightroom, whatever you like. You know, it doesn't really matter what. But you move into sort of the regular editor you would use in normal life. And what I tend to do, actually, is I tend to take all of these intermediate stages, import them all into aperture, stack them with the original, and then put this final one as the stack pick, and then edit that. So that I have the intermediate stages if I want to revisit it later.
Right.
Because I actually find a lot of the time that my skill at these things improves, and I do sometimes like to revisit. But maybe I'm happy with the output from Photomatix, but I just want to redo the topaz or whatever. So I just save the intermediate stages and just stack them all. So then we're into aperture for the final leg. And the first thing is just basically something actually that Apple did very well in aperture is the default ordering of the bricks, which is sort of the blocks of sliders, are actually the order you should do them in. They're sort of a suggestion of your workflow is the default order. And I pretty much always follow that suggestion because it's actually very sensible.
And I'll just interject the mm-hmm. Lightroom blocks are pretty much in this order. I think they're exactly in this order. Some of the sliders are different as far as what they call them, but this is the order that they have you work through also in Lightroom.
Which again implies that there's something to it.
Yeah. They can't both be wrong, right?
You'd imagine, unless one of them's copying off the other. But I don't think so. I think they're both apps written by independent-minded companies. So step one is a crop, and I have absolutely no problem cropping images. Because I will very often in my mind say, well, actually, this is going to need to be a more sort of a panoramic crop, but obviously my camera is the shape it is, so I will take it and I know I'm going to crop it later. And that's actually what was the case here, because all of the stuff of interest is on a line along the middle of the image, really. So you have the track disappearing into the background, the train, the sunset. They're all on a plane within the image. So obviously, having it being as tall as it came out of the camera is just distracting. So I always knew this was going to be a panoramic crop. And so the first thing to do is just to crop it down to that aspect ratio. So 16:9 aspect ratio.
Oh, right. Yeah, it looks good. Jumping below, I see that what you've done, and it looks a lot better. You're right. It looks better. It also takes out is that a railing or something on the left-hand side?
Basically, when you're looking through the eyepiece, you actually see 98% of what you're going to get in the picture. And so when I had framed that in the field, I didn't have that silly railing on the bridge, but it snuck in there all the same.
Right.
So yeah, get rid of that. That's just distracting.
Yeah.
And then crop it to 16:9.
Which again is don't listen to those people that say don't crop your images. Crop it to make it better. Fix your composition.
Yeah. And I will intentionally shoot a little too wide sometimes, because especially if you're shooting something that's moving, you're not going to be perfectly accurate. So give yourself the spare. You have, you know, modern cameras have far too many megapixels, so it's okay to crop a few off.
Yes.
Now, because we shot with a manually set white balance, we don't have to mess with the white balance. So you'll notice the checkbox on the white balance brick is off. Just not applied. Not needed. Then a few exposure tweaks. You know, standard stuff. In this case, brightened a little bit of recovery. Black point tweaked a little bit. Just, you know, your basic make it exposed right. Then in the enhanced block, plenty of vibrancy. Because the whole feeling of dusk is those rich colours. And so that's your vibrancy slider. Not your saturation slider, your vibrancy slider, because it's just a much more clever type of saturation. That's just a different name for you guys, isn't it? It's not vibrancy.
Nope.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah. And it's in the opposite order. Vibrancy is above saturation, but its vibrance.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that I will sometimes do, if it's useful, it wasn't helpful in this image, but the definition slider is another one of my favorites. I didn't use it for this image because it didn't need it. But sometimes it does.
And it's like our clarity.
It is exactly like your clarity, yes.
So it's midpoint contrast. Is that what it's? I
believe that's the technical term for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
To some extent, it's doing the job that Topaz Adjust does for you, but Topaz Adjust has lots of sliders to control it, rather than just a single slider for definition / clarity.
Right, and my understanding is that it's doing the same. The contrast slider is the overall contrast of the image from top to bottom, and the definition or clarity is doing that just more to the midpoint of the image.
It's also a local sort of thing. It looks at the pixels around the pixel it's currently working on, and then decides what to do based on what's around it. So it's sort of a smart contrast.
Okay, right. Yes.
Again, I don't use saturation because that leads to a much less natural image. So I go for the vibrancy, and in this case, that's a lot of vibrance. Right. To me, that's moving the slider a long way, putting it to 0.26, right? Because it starts off in the very middle. So to me, that's a dramatic adjustment. Right? Going back to previous point, subtle, subtle, subtle. And I am a huge believer in the power of curves adjustments. I don't like using the alternative one where you basically have the three sliders, your midpoint, shadow, and highlights. I hate the levels adjustment. I'm a huge fan of curves. So I have levels taken out of my default set of aperture bricks, and I have curves put in instead. I just love curves adjustments. So I pretty much always end up applying an S-curve, which is just a nice way to get overall contrast. It's basically dark in the darks, you lighten the lights.
And in Lightroom, you don't have a levels adjustment, you only have a curves.
Good, good. That's how it should be.
Yeah. And I didn't have Lightroom open, but I opened it while we were talking, and the word is vibrance. So vibrancy in aperture and vibrance in...
Okay, that's similar enough that people will figure it out, thank goodness.
Yeah, exactly.
So a curves adjustment to finish it off, and then that is the easy aperture stuff done. So that is the apply to the whole image stuff done, and then we need to fine-tune. So if you look at the result now, we have, at this stage, we have solved the dynamic range issue, right? There is an appropriate amount of detail in the foreground, the sky is fine, the train has become visible. We have dealt with the first of our two problems to be solved. But by adding lots of colour, by bringing that vibrancy up, we have actually made the second of our two problems to be solved worse. So the light balance in the sky is correct. By putting on the vibrancy, the sky looks lovely. The white balance on the ground is wrong. And by sliding up that vibrancy, we have made it the wrongness more obvious. It is too blue. It has a horrible blue tone.
Right, okay.
Right, and we've made it worse.
That's fine. I see that.
Because we're now going to deal with it. So this is the bit that took me years to figure out how to do this in a sensible way. And the answer is to use my now favorite brick in aperture, which is the color adjustment brick. And the way this works is you drop a little dropper on whatever it is you want to tweak. So I will drop it on something that's approximately neutral gray. So the train would do fine. The concrete will do fine. That's a gray color. And what you will see is that it will pick up blue as being the overriding color in that foreground, which is the color we don't want. So once I get my blue dropped, I then desaturate it to about minus 0.5-ish. And then I pull back the luminance on it as well. So I desaturate and darken the blues in the foreground. And that color cast off. But now the important bit is you have to click the paint on adjustment because we don't want to break the sky.
Oh, there we go. That was where you stumped me, and I was going to say, wait a minute, how did we get rid of the lower half blue but leave this blue in the sky alone? So now you're going to tell me.
So the magic ingredient is that aperture allows you to brush in adjustments. So you click the little cogwheel and say brush in adjustment. The adjustment will then vanish from the image except where you brush it. So basically everything that's in shadow, you brush in this strip away blue adjustment effectively. and then the rest of the image stays unaffected. Now, what I also... So in this case, that's the first thing, and that gets the image looking natural. And then it's a case of making it look as good as it can. So in this case, there's actually three other color adjustments. So the first one is that the sky actually could do with being a little bit more blue. So I drop another blue adjustment on the sky, and this time I increase the saturation, but darken it as well. So both blues get darkened, but the one in the sky gets saturated and darkened, whereas the one on the ground gets desaturated and darkened. Brush that in on just the sky, and then we have a nicer blue in the sky. The next thing I always do, so in Europe, all trains legally have to have, or so every time you repaint a train as of a certain year, you have to paint a certain shade of yellow onto the front so that you don't run over people, I think is the logic. And it's actually quite a reflective paint. So it's that kind of paint you use on road signs that sort of shines back at you.
Right.
And that doesn't really come out properly in a photograph. So I will drop a color dropper onto that, increase its saturation, increase its brightness, and paint it in on just the front of the train, which sort of puts back the shimmeriness, sort of, that was there in real life. And also it makes the front of the train a focal point of the image, which is sort of what you want. And then in this case, some idiot...
It was convenient of them to put that yellow there for you.
It really was, actually. It makes train photography in Europe much easier, because you always have a striking front. Now, in this case, some idiot hung a luminous green banner off the bridge. Now, it's behind the railing, so it's half greyed out, but it's still annoying to me and distracting. So I took a dropper onto that luminous green, and I desaturated it all the way to zero and deluminated it all the way to zero, effectively turning it into a sort of a non-existent grey. Effectively just removes it without cloning it out.
Well, and it's the location of it. I didn't actually notice it right away until you pointed it out, so... But now that you did point it out, mm-hmm. it jumps out and it's right below the sun, so it...
Yeah, it really distracts from where you want the eye to go.
Yeah.
So, gone. Goodbye. And so at this stage now, we have done four color adjustments. We've desaturated and darkened the blues in the foreground. We've saturated and darkened the blues in the sky. We've enhanced the front of the cab and we've removed the silly green banner. And we now have an almost finished image. The last step is to use a vignette and some exposure tweaks, local exposure tweaks, to focus the eye where we want the eye to go. Now, depending on the image, I very often paint in my vignettes, because if you have a leading line coming through the image, like if you go right back up to the top to the examples, the one with the path next to the canal, I would never vignette out a path that's acting as a leading line. So I would apply the vignette to say everything in the image apart from the path. So basically, apply the vignettes where it makes sense to apply the vignettes. Again, you can brush any adjustment in an aperture. So in this case, the vignette is applied not to the sky, just to the ground.
Okay.
And even with the vignette, I wasn't quite happy that the distractions in the sort of the bottom left had been properly dealt with. So I actually took... I used Dodge and Burn to extra darken the distracting bits in the bottom left. So there's a vignette in the bottom half of the image, and then there's a little bit of extra darkening for the stuff I just really wanted away.
When you say you painted in the vignette, you're doing an exposure paint or just the...
No, the vignette brick in aperture has the little cogwheel where you can say brush in adjustment.
Okay.
And so you can have a vignette, but only in the places you want. So it is a vignette adjustment, which means it blends nicely. You don't have to worry about doing that subtle blend from edge of the frame in.
Right, okay. Yeah, you stop using a piece of software for a year and you forget, so I forgot.
No, I just adore the fact that Aperture lets you paint pretty much everything. So it's always, that's a nice little touch. And so the aim here is to make sure that the eye is drawn to the cab of the train and the setting sun, and so really the... And at that stage, we have ourselves what I consider to be the finished image, which is, I would like to think, naturalistic, and yet really quite different from where we started.
And I don't know if you know, Bart, but I lost you for a second.
Oh.
After I had made a comment about forgetting how to use vignette in aperture, mm-hmm. You dropped off for me.
Oh, dear. Well, the quick version is basically that sort of... By using the vignette and the dodge and burn to sort of pull the eye to the train and the sun, that is the final finishing touch to make an image I'm happy to pop onto Flickr.
and it looks great.
I'm certainly happy to have my name on it.
Yeah, it's one of those things that you're not going to spend that much time with every single image that you ever do, but it also is worthwhile on some of these images like this, because you can really get a really interesting image to share out with people. So you're not going to do it every time, but it's worth doing the work. Sometimes people say, oh, you shouldn't work that hard on an image, but I think it's worth it on ones where you have the odd dynamic range or the colors.
The way I sort of look at it is, you don't, you know, on average, you want to be putting in no more than 2 or 3 minutes of work per image. But there's loads of images that just take 30 seconds.
Right.
And so if you do 50 of those, you've earned yourself quite a lot of time to spend on a good image.
That's a good way to look at it.
You know, because you're right. I mean, you couldn't do this to every image, but sometimes it's worth it. I mean, how often, especially living in Ireland and visiting Belgium sometimes, I don't very often get to see the sun disk actually on the horizon. That's a real treat for me, because we very rarely have such a clear sky.
Well, and I think the other issue is that sometimes people might hear this workflow and they'll say to you, oh, you know, you can't make a good image out of a bad image. If it's bad and it needs that much adjustment, well, it's just a bad image. And that might be true on a lot of images where you say, okay, you can't make a bad image you can't make a good image out of a bad image, no matter how much processing you do. But that's not what we're doing here. What you're doing is you're taking a situation that our eyes can see, and it's a good quote unquote subject. It's a good picture, but the technology of our camera just can't capture it. So we are using the processing to get that good image back. I think that's the difference.
Yeah, we're not trying to compensate for a mistake. We're working around the problem to be solved, which is mixed white balance and extreme dynamic range. So it's a very, very different thing to saying, whoopsie daisies, I forgot to focus, I'll just fix it in post. No, you won't.
Right. Right, exactly. Yeah.
So there is a difference between taking a shot with the intention of applying a process and making a mistake and trying to cover it.
And I think that goes back to where you started, which is you knew when you took the image that what you were going to go through to get it to be a good image, to be a final image. So again, it's not fixing a mistake. You started at the very beginning with, I know that this isn't going to turn out of camera, but I'm going to give myself the bits of light that I'm going to need to work with down the road to make a good image.
Exactly. Now, if people go to Twin Lakes Images, they'll see that you've also taken sort of very similar style images. And there was two I picked out, which were taken in tulip fields. Now, I think you pointed out the big difference between your shots and mine is that I work in the evening because I don't do mornings, whereas you like sunrise. But the light is the same, right?
The light is the same. And these are favorite images, but I will say I do a lot more shooting at night than I do in the morning, because it requires you to get up really early. And I did it twice this year to get up in the tulips. You've selected two images to show that were actually shot two different days, but it's both of them sunrise. Had to get up really early and drive up north and get to the tulips. So the one image, and I'm assuming you're going to throw these into the notes.
I'll be sticking the books in the show notes.
Yeah, the one image was the first one that I did when I drove up there, and it pink tulips in the foreground, and then the trees and the hills and yellow sky in the background. And in that one, with the mist and so forth, so it was kind of an odd sunrise day as far as we didn't really get a nice sunburst, but because of the mist, we were getting all kinds of color in the sky in that mist and silhouetting out the trees and so forth. But it also created a pretty difficult situation because of the wide dynamic range between trying to get something decent out of the flowers and getting the sky and not have it blow out one way or the other.
And your workflow, is it in any way similar to the one I've sort of settled on?
It is very similar. I don't think in either one of the... I use Photomatics, but as I said, I don't feel like I've gotten good at it. Now that you, now that we've walked through this conversation, I think I'm going to maybe try a lot more and see if I can't do a better job. But because I don't do a very good job with Photomatics, I don't tend to throw myself there, even though the image might call for it. And what I tend to do is, and even when I go to Photomatics, what I tend to do is, and maybe this is a mistake, but my workflow is I do a lot more of my adjusting in Lightroom first to try to get things close to where I think they need to be. And for instance, one of the issues that I tend to find is that when you go to Photomatics or even Topaz, if there's any chromatic aberration at all, it'll exaggerate that when you do the adjustments in those other programs. So I try to make sure some of those things are cleaned up and out of the image before I go out to Photomatics or to Topaz. But the one that we're talking about first with the pink flowers and the yellow sky, trying to remember the process, but basically I work through the image as best I can all the way through. So from top to bottom of those adjustments in Lightroom. And then I take it into Topaz and try to just bump it a little bit because get some of the local adjustments, get some of the, or not local adjustments, but the doing the, oh shoot.
The adaptive exposure. Yeah, because the adaptive
exposure. There you go. Thank you. That was the word I was looking for, the adaptive exposure.
It can indeed be used to give a very tone mapping like effect, because what it's done for you here is it's definitely, I'm pretty sure it's brightened up those tulips and darkened down that sky.
And the tulips and the, it brings out the greens, it gives some detail to the leaves and the stems and so forth, because those were really dark in the original RAW. They're basically lost.
They're very important. Right? Yeah. Those greens are what give you the sense that you're standing between those tulips and looking out at that lovely sunrise.
Right. Yeah. So that was really important. So I think that was basically the main way that I did that was to go through Lightroom and then take it into Topaz and just make some very small, very subtle adjustments in Topaz to make it pop and give some detail and edge to it.
Cool. And was it a similar approach then for the one with the sunburst?
Yeah, and that very similar approach, but that one we had an even worse
dynamic range, is because you're shooting into the sun.
I actually stopped because I had to think about this. I actually think this was a composite. I think this is two images.
That's again a very good way of dealing with the problem.
Yeah, I think what I ended up doing, and this basically like your explanation, I knew when I was taking the pictures that I was going to have a problem with the dynamic range. I knew what the issue was going to be here, so I was actually taking a series of images. The camera's on the tripod. So hopefully I don't get a lot of movement or change in the, so I don't get any kind of ghosting or anything. And this particular image is two images. It's I exposed for the sky and had a really, I think it was probably F20 or 22 or something. Cause I wanted to get a nice burst. I knew that that's what I was shooting for. And then I would expose for the, then I'd expose for the flowers, and I did a whole series of those. And then when I brought them back, I picked out the ones that I liked the best and took two images. So I believe that is a composite, pretty much cut where the horizon is, where you see the tree line and the edge of the flowers. I think that's the upper and the lower.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So, but processed each of them individually in Lightroom to get them where I wanted, and then I took them into Photoshop and did a blending of the two so that I could get that.
Which again, you know, the problem to be solved is the same. It's just a different approach. And the great thing with photography, like any art, is that there's an infinity of right answers.
Well, and I mean, the compositing two images is going to work okay if. Well, at
you
my
can find a joint at, that looks
I was gonna,
natural.
Right, I was going to say at my skill level. I don't want to say this for all photographers because I know there's photographers that are much more skilled at blending images in Photoshop. But I don't have a real high skill level at it, and this particular image gives me a really sharp horizon, an easy place to blend. This was not a difficult image to do a composite blend because the line is so sharp. Yeah. And you know, if we really zoomed in, we might see the line, but the way that this image is set up, the flowers at the horizon aren't in focus, and the trees at the horizon are black and not in focus, plus there's the haze in there, so really I didn't have to be too terribly careful about the blending of the images, because it's not, you're not really going to notice it in the image, but obviously your image, the train one, would have been pretty hard to do that.
Yeah, anything with it, especially a tree line of leafless winter trees is a nightmare for blending.
Right.
So I guess actually if you were to do a blend, you could use the top of the bridge railings, the top of the train, and then you'd have a slightly bumpy horizon. You could probably get away with it, actually.
Although, it's going to be tough.
The rooftops. Yeah, it's messy, it's, yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot tougher. And, you know, this one, I certainly don't do that all the time. But that's how that image was done. I had to think back, and I remember that it's two images composited.
And, I mean, there's all sorts of sort of mixes of the two approaches, because sometimes if you're tone mapping, you're just going to ruin the sky. And what I will find myself doing, if I have no choice, is to tone map the ground and keep the original sky and mush those together. You know, well, blend those together. And the one tip I would have if you're blending bits of images is when you're doing the layering, use a soft-edged brush. That way you
right.
don't have... Because if you have a harsh line, your eye will see it. Whereas if you're a little bit wrong with a fuzzy brush, it's fine.
Well, and I did it in Photoshop, but I didn't do anything too terribly...
Yeah, I would usually do it in Pixelmator because
right. And that's what I was going to say is I didn't do anything too terribly fancy. I think you could do it in any kind of software that any kind of processing that's going to let you layer is going to let you do that. In fact, you could probably do this in Topaz using the Photomatics or the PhotoFX Lab because they lets you layer too. So you
it does let you layer, but it.
You nice. Couldn't do two images. That's
it's a bit clunky. You can drag and drop in the other image. It can be done, but actually I find that Pixelmator is a much nicer
right.
feel to it. The PhotoFX Lab is a bit clunky. It works, and I use it, but it's a bit clunky.
The other thing to answer the question, I got sidetracked mm-hmm. saying that this was two images composited, but backtracking a bit, the images... Each individual image, I did go through the process that we're talking about here, which, in particular, the tulips, again, the stems and the leaves are very black, and the tops of the tulips are much brighter because they're obviously the parts getting the light. So I had to go through and do the adjustments to bring out the detail in the shadows, and I did that in Lightroom and a combination of Lightroom and Topaz. I don't think either one of these went into Photomatics, but
again,
I do.
Photomatics is not something you have to invest to take, you know, to get good results because there are other ways.
Right. Yeah.
So I think I just sort of want to end on the idea that right, I've sort of laid out my workflow, but that's not to say. This is the way to do things. It's more to say that people have asked, how do I do it? Well, this is how. But every photographer is going to tackle things in their own way, and hopefully it's just food for thought. You know, your workflow is different to my workflow, but at the end of the day, we're all tackling the same problems. We're just looking for different solutions to the same problem to be solved.
And I think the other thing that I heard you say, and I know that I have developed, which is be methodical. If you can kind of figure out what the workflow is, work from top to bottom, be methodical, because one of the things that I've learned over time is that if I jump around, I can't remember what I tweaked. And it's sort of like, oh, I had a good image and now I've lost the good image and I can't remember what's affecting what. If you go through methodically, you can remember what you're doing and you get through it more organized. And I think the other thing that I've learned definitely is small tweaks, subtle tweaks. If you want to be artistic and push the slider a long ways, you certainly can do that. And I'm not saying that's wrong, but if what we're trying to do is get a more realistic image, small tweaks are better.
Less is very often more.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Mark, thank you very much. It's been a fun segment. I'd just remind people where they can look at your photography, be it tulips or Twin Lakes or anything else you've taken pictures of.
Well, I want to thank you for having me on. I'm a little reluctant. You said I was taking Allison's place. She's going to be pretty upset when she hears that on the recording, but that's all right. Well, she'll just have to deal with it. People can find my work, and I certainly would like people to stop over to my webpage, which is twinlakesimages.com. I try to change it up and change out the pictures and keep it up to date with my newest stuff. That's where I would like people to go see it. But I'm also active on Flickr as Switcher Mark and active on Twitter as Switcher Mark as well.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much, Mark. And I know you also are a regular on Let's Talk Photography, which is my photography podcast. So if you thought this conversation was fun, then this is kind of what Let's Talk Photography is like, isn't it?
It is, and it's a lot of fun. I'm very much enjoying being on that show.
Great to have you. Anyway, with that, I'm not sure how I'm going to end this segment. How's about happy snapping?
sounds appropriate. Thanks, Bart.
Okay, bye, Mark.
Bye.
Well, that brings us to the end of another fairly long Nosilicast. Sorry about that, Alison. Surprise, surprise, I went a little bit too long. I guess I had too much fun talking to Mark for chit-chat across the pond. Anyway, thanks very much to everyone who sent in recordings. You made my life a lot easier. Also, thanks for the dumb question. And the last thing I'll just say is that the last time I did a Nosilicast, I had terrible problems because I was using GarageBand. This is my first Nosilicast using Amadeus Pro, and this isn't a review by any means, but so far I can say that I have not had to swear out at once while producing an entire show. So I think it's safe to say I prefer Amadeus Pro to GarageBand. Anyway, till next time, happy computing!